Hello and welcome to the 12th episode of Orthodoxy, Autocracy and Nationality, the Third Rome, Origins of Russians of the Russian Tsardom. Now, today we are going to be starting with a new format. As it so happened, Marcus has had some problems connecting to the internet, so it's just going to be me this evening delivering the first part of this two-part episode. The first part is going to be me delivering an overview of the period in a lecture format. It will last about an hour, or 40 minutes to an hour. And then on Friday, we are scheduled to have a seminar section involving the texts which are featured here in the description. So there will be a lecture section and then a discussion section with Marcus Furius Pertinax and Columba. But for this evening, it's just going to be me, hopefully providing an interesting lecture about the overview of the reigns of Ivan III, Ivan IV, and the creation of the Russian Tsardom. So let us begin, shall we? Moscow began as nothing more than an insignificant hill fort in the shadow of the regional capital, Vladimir Suzdal. And yet after the Mongol decimation of the Kievan Rus, Daniel Alexandrovich, Ivan Kalita, and their successors turned Moscow into the principal city of Russia under the Mongol yoke, becoming first exalted subjects of the Horde, then, under Dmitry Donskoy, propagators of Russian independence and unification. In the words of B.A. Upenskishi, after the fall of Byzantium, the Muscovite state attempted to enact a restoration of the Byzantine Empire. Thus originated the Tsardom of Russia, which subsequently became the Russian Empire. The Tsardom was modelled as a theocratic one, with Moscow conceived as the new Constantinople and the Third Rome. In conformity with this conception, there appeared in Moscow, as in the new Constantinople, a Tsar, that is, a Basileus or Emperor. Notably, the Byzantine Emperor had been called Tsar in Russia, so that Peter I's assumption of the title of Emperor in 1721 designated a change of cultural orientation toward the West and not an elevation of rank. As a result of this new orientation towards Byzantium, Russia acquired both a Tsar and eventually a Patriarch. However, by this time, Byzantium had long gone. Thus, the Russians modelled themselves not on a tradition that actually existed, but on a certain notion of a theocratic state, the leading Orthodox state, creating a system of government that was uniquely Russian. To recap from the end of our last stream on Russia, that being episode 8, The Mongol Yoke, after the death of Yanibeg of the Golden Horde and the Moscow princes Simeon and Ivan II, control of the Rus fell to Dmitry Donskoy. Wary of the power of Moscow, the Golden Horde, on the pretext that Dmitry was a minor, bestowed the rank of Grand Prince onto a rival prince, that of Nizhny Novgorod, which Dmitry quickly won back in 1363. In continuing with Moscow's old rivalry with Tver, the Prince of Tver invited Algirdas of Lithuania to sack Moscow in the so-called Litovshina in an escalating series of raids. With the construction of the Moscow Kremlin in 1367, the city survived, and the Lithuanians were forced to retreat. Due to the decline of the Horde, Dmitry was the first Muscovite prince to openly challenge Mongol authority. Leading the Russian principalities, under the aegis of liberating the Orthodox from Mongol rule, he defeated the Horde general Maimai at the battles of Vorzhia in 1378 and the Great Battle of Kulikovo in 1380, later immortalized in Sofonny's contemporary poem, the Zadonshina. The original defiance of Dmitry was short-lived, however, as Toktamish briefly restored the power of the Horde and, after sacking Moscow in 1382, compelled Dmitry into submission until Dmitry's death in 1389. Nevertheless, Dmitry had left Muscovy far larger and more powerful than he found it. His son Vasily, the first to inherit the rank of Grand Prince, rather than have it bestowed by the Khan, at first stopped paying tribute until the Khan's raids into Moscow in 1408. Vasily's reign was mainly peaceful, undertaking no dramatic attempts at independence from the Horde, who even gifted Vasily the city of Nizhny Novgorod for his loyalty. Meanwhile, he largely acquiesced to the rapid expansion of Lithuania to the west with the conquest of Smolensk. Instead, Muscovy expanded northeast toward the Ural Mountains. Meanwhile, St. Sergius was founding hundreds of monasteries further to the north in increasingly inhospitable locations, such as Belizero, expanding the local economy and acting as vehicles for Muscovite culture. The Muscovites had successfully preserved the unity of their realm through primogeniture, whereas the Kievan Rus lateral succession which we discussed in depth on episode 7, had led to the demise of many other principalities, which were subsequently absorbed by Moscow. Nevertheless, after the death of Vasily I, he was succeeded by his 10-year-old son, Vasily II. With a minor on the throne, Vasily II's uncles pressed their own claims to the throne on the basis of the old succession right. In 1433, Vasily II was deposed by his uncle, but not killed, allowing him to return and then depose his uncle in turn. The claim to the throne was taken up by Yuri's son, Vasily, who was captured and blinded. With his throne nominally secure, Vasily II waged war against the Golden Horde successor, Khanate of Kazan, only to be taken prisoner. When he was ransomed back to Moscow, Dmitry Shemyaka, his regent, had Vasily II blinded and exiled before Vasily once again retook the throne. By 1453, the now blinded Vasily II had eliminated any contenders to his authority, but was forced to rely on his son Ivan to rule due to his incapacity. Vasily II had successfully defended primogeniture in Moscow, and further centralized the Muscovite state to be greatly expanded and elevated under his son Ivan III, the great gatherer of lands, a recurring term in Russian historiography. By the time of Ivan's accession in 1462, Moscow had become the vehicle of the Russian language. The dialects of the Rus Old East Slavic language, originally centering on Kiev, began to differentiate into Russian and Ruthenian, Ruthenian being the ancestor of our modern languages Ukrainian and Belarusian, roughly demarcated by the Muscovite-Lithuanian border, while Old Church Slavonic was replaced by New Church Slavonic as the Russian liturgical language and prestige dialect. Moscow's only remaining rival, thanks to the decline of Tver and Ryazan, was the Grand Republic of Novgorod, though it was less a military threat than a commercial threat, owing to the Republic's domination of the fur trade. The Republic had been on friendly terms with Moscow during the early 14th century in opposition to Tver, inviting the Muscovite princes to become the princes of Novgorod. The Republic was dominated by a few dozen boyar families, none of whom could contend with the power of the Danilovich dynasty of Moscow, and so were content to offer them nominal rule, leaving the Republic to deal with its own affairs under an elected posadnik, or steward. From a single posadnikdom, Novgorod multiplied the number of posadniks by the 15th century as a power-sharing measure among the boyars, leaving the Archbishop of Novgorod as the de facto head of the Republic. The ambition of the Muscovites and the decline of Tver caused the Republic to gravitate towards the burgeoning Grand Duchy of Lithuania. One of the sons of Algirdas, Lengvenis, a vassal of the King Jagiello of Poland, converted to Orthodoxy from Catholicism and was elected prince after the death of Moscow's Dmitry Donskoy. After the triumph of Vasily II over Dmitry Shemyaka, in which Novgorod had played a pivotal role, Novgorod Archbishop Efimi II negotiated the Treaty of Yazhelbitsy, in which the integrity of the Republic would be respected in return for the Republic surrendering control of its foreign affairs to Moscow, making Moscow the nominal suzerain of Novgorod. In 1471, Marfa Posadnitsa, matriarch of the anti-Muscovite Boretsky family, with the consent of then-Archbishop Theophile, attempted to negotiate the annexation of the Republic to Lithuania, lest the vast wealth of the boyars be appropriated by the ambitious Ivan III of Moscow. A Lithuanian prince, Mikhailo Alekovich, was summoned to Novgorod to marry Marfa Posadnitsa and become regent of Novgorod. Among the retinue of Alekovich was one Shekhadiah the Jew, who introduced the Judaizer heresy to the city. The term Judaizer was a pejorative for what was ultimately a heterodox Orthodox movement, whose members, typically low-ranking Orthodox clergymen, were accused of thinking like Jews. The theological origin of this movement can be dated back earlier than Shekhadiah the Jew to the Stoligolniki movement of Novgorod, popular among the merchants of the city. Their grievances were with the corruption and exhortations of the clergy and the structured hierarchy of the church. Combined with their iconoclastic tendencies, they share similarities with other proto-Reformation heresies such as the Cathars in southern France. Ivan III used Novgorod's friendly overtures to Lithuania as a pretext to wage war on the Republic on the basis that, 1. Novgorod had violated the Treaty of Yazhelbitsy by inviting a foreign ruler to govern the city at Muscovite expense. 2. That Novgorod had committed apostasy against the Orthodox Church by submitting to a Catholic power. Ivan III decisively defeated the Republic's force at Chalon. The commander of the army, Dmitry Boretsky, of the same family as Marfa, was executed. The Polish alliance was in tatters. Though the city retained its independence until 1478, Ivan began confiscating church and noble lands within the Republic, causing the Boyars once again to turn to Lithuania for one last time, precipitating a final invasion by Ivan, during which Archbishop Theophil consented to Moscow's annexation of the Republic. Subsequent revolts against Ivan led to the dispossession of the wealthiest of the Boyar families and the downfall of Theophil himself. Many of the families were relocated to Moscow, thereafter the unquestioned seat of Russian power until the Petrine era of the 18th century, and by Petrine, obviously Peter the Great. Novgorod would endure three purges during Ivan's lifetime, often directed against the Boyars. Other minor principalities gathered under Ivan include Yaroslavl, Rostov, Belozersk, and the great principality of Tver, formerly a great rival to Moscow in 1485. Unwilling to countenance the fragmentation of his realm through the grant of appanages to his younger siblings in Novgorod, and even less a return to the collateral succession that had doomed the unity of the Kievan Rus, Ivan defeated his brothers and fended off a Lithuanian intervention on their behalf. Ivan outlived his brothers Yuri, Andrei, and Boris, ensuring that the territories they had inherited from their father, Vasily II, reverted to the Grand Prince, ending the era of the independent Rus princelings, ushered in with the death of Yaroslav the Wise 400 years prior. Having united Russia, Ivan III finally threw off the Mongol yoke, completing a process that had begun under his predecessor, Dmitry Donskoy. In 1476, Ivan refused to pay the customary tribute to Sarai, and in the ensuing standoff between the Muscovite forces and Khan Ahmed of the Golden Horde at the Uga River, the Khan fled rather than confront Ivan in battle. As a result of his cowardice and the diminished position, ultimately conceding the loss of Muscovy, the Khan was assassinated the following year, and the Horde fragmented into a series of smaller Khanates, the largest one ultimately being the Astrakhan Khanate. Of those tiny little remnant Khanates, they began to gravitate towards the burgeoning empire of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. In the absence of a great Khan of the Golden Horde, the successor Khanate of Kazan accepted Russian suzerainty, and the Khanate of Crimea came under Ottoman influence, and paradoxically would often act in concert with Russian military overtures against Lithuania. With the Horde defeated, Ivan turned his imperial ambitions west to Sweden, where he unsuccessfully invaded Finland, and to Lithuania. Lithuania's union with Poland was briefly suspended with the death of Casimir IV and the ascension of Grand Duke Alexander, affording Ivan the opportunity to reverse a century of Lithuanian gains at Russian expense. Now, if we remember back to our episode on the Mongol yoke, the traditional power centres, Chernigov, Politovsk, Kiev, had all become subsumed into the Grand Duchy of Lithuania as a result of the Golden Horde's inability to defend the border of Moscow, to defend the border of Russia, thereby leaving Moscow and the centre of Russian power much further to the east than it had historically been. After a short border war, in which Alexander agreed to marry Ivan's daughter, Ivan exploited the Ottoman campaigns against Hungary and Poland to win a decisive victory against the Lithuanians at the Battle of the Vidorosha River. In 1503, the two sides concluded a peace treaty whereby Lithuania ceded a third of its territory, including the ancient city of Chernigov, to Russia. From this indomitable position, Ivan laid the foundations of the Tsardom of Russia, which would be developed further by his grandson Ivan IV. 150 years prior, Ivan I Kalita, or Moneybags, had received the Monomach cap from Uzbek Khan, the Monomach cap, of course, being the famous headgear of the Tsars before the change in heraldry with the ascent of Peter the Great. After receiving the Monomach cap from Uzbek Khan, Moscow was established as the successor to Vladimir Suzdal, itself the successor of Kiev, and Moscow became the seat of the Metropolitan of Kiev, the highest spiritual authority in Russia, albeit an essential component of Mongol rule in Russia. In 1453, Constantinople, known as Tsargrad, or the imperial city to the Muscovites, fell to the Turks, leaving Moscow as the most powerful Orthodox nation. On the initiative of Pope Paul II, Ivan III was married to Constantine XI's niece, Zoe, later Sophia Palaiologina. Sophie was the daughter of Thomas, the last despot of Morea, and claimant to the imperial throne of Byzantium. After the fall of Morea to the Ottomans, Sophia had been raised a Catholic under the protection of the popes of Rome. It had been the intention of the papacy to woo Ivan III with the notion of an imperial match, while Sophia would act as an agent of Catholicism in Russia with the potential to bring about a union of the churches, as had been achieved very controversially under John VIII of Byzantium at the Council of Florence some 50 years prior. This effort was an unmitigated failure, as she had repudiated her Catholicism and become not only an advocate of orthodoxy, but of imperial pretensions of the Muscovite monarchy. Unlike the other women of the Muscovite court, who were traditionally isolated from political affairs, and from the men in court in general, Sophia represented her husband to foreign ambassadors, using her title of despoina, inherited from her father's title of despot. Through her influence, Muscovy adopted elements of Byzantine court etiquette. Over time, Ivan himself would use the title Tsar or Caesar in foreign affairs and foreign correspondence, though his preferred title domestically was that of Gospodar or Gosudar, meaning sovereign of all the Rus. His inherited title was Grand Prince of Muscovy. From 1497, the Gosudar seal contained here, as you can see in the center of this picture, the emblem of the Byzantine double eagle, the imperial emblem of Constantinople and the second Rome. In Moscow, Ivan embarked on a series of grand building projects, utilizing the services of Italian architects such as Fioravanti to construct the Dormitian Cathedral in the Kremlin, the new seat of the Moscow Metropolitans, and thereafter used as for all Muscovite coronations, all the way up until Nicholas II. These imperial pretensions were far from superficial. In the same year, Ivan's scribe Guseyev compiled the Suebnik, the first collection of laws for the entirety of Russia, as opposed to the patchwork nature of feudal legal systems that had existed before. The powerful Russian aristocracy had been reduced to a service nobility around the Tsar, rather than the powerful independent princelings with their standing armies. The nobility were organized around the Menichesvo, which delineated the seniority of Russia's clans. The boyars were reduced to contesting which among them had the right to occupy a seat at the Tsar's table and which exact seat they should occupy. The caveat for Ivan was that in his attempts to centralize and govern Russia as an absolute autocratic monarchy, these government positions were given not on account of noble, not on account of merit and therefore of use to the Tsar, but on noble rank, a flaw for the autocracy which subsequent Tsars would attempt to rectify. The marriage of Ivan and Sophia, while a boon for Russia's prestige and later apotheosis as the Third Rome, created problems for the succession. Ivan had a young son, Ivan Ivanovich, from his previous marriage to Maria of Tver, who in turn had produced an heir, Dmitri, while Sophia had fought for the rights of her son, Vasily. When Ivan the younger suddenly died of gout, Sophia was accused of poisoning her stepson. When both Sophia and Vasily were accused of plotting against Prince Dmitri, the two were banished from the court. Dmitri was then elevated as his grandfather's co-ruler in 1498, his succession seemingly assured. Dmitri had his own advocate in court, his formidable mother, Elena of Moldavia, Sophia's arch-rival. And yet, thanks to Sophia's intrigues, both Vasily and Sophia were restored to the court the next year, and Vasily vested with real authority as the governor of Novgorod. By contrast, Dmitri had been vested with no actual tangible authority, only the empty title of co-ruler. In the end, the demise of Elena and Dmitri came part in thanks to the intrigues of Sophia and the persecution of the Judaea heresy aforementioned. The Judaea heresy had arrived in Novgorod some decades prior. Under the Archbishop of Gennady of Novgorod, the Russians adopted their own version of the Spanish Inquisition to root out the heretics. Ivan III had originally been receptive toward the Judaizers, alongside this, however, due to the increasingly hostile approach led by Archbishop Gennady of Novgorod, he aligned with the Sobors, or the church councils, to persecute them. Shakira the Jew was executed in 1491. Aline and Dmitri's faction in court had been sympathetic to the Judaizers, providing a pretext for their fall from favour, while prominent leaders of the movement were executed after a definitive Sobor against the heresy in 1503. Dmitri was stripped of his title, which was transferred to Vasily. Sophia did not live long enough to see her son succeed. With the death of Ivan III, both Elena and Dmitri were imprisoned, the latter in all likelihood suffocated on the orders of Vasily. Vasily III continued the policies of his father, capturing the major city of Smolensk from the Lithuanians, relying on his Lithuanian turncoat, Mikhail Glinski, annexing the cities of Pskov and the Principality of Ryazan. Like his father, he had used the informal device of Tsar in foreign correspondence. Yet after 20 years of rule, it became apparent that his wife, Solomnia Sabulova, was barren, nor did Vasily want to abandon the policy of primogeniture by leaving the throne to be contested by his remaining brothers. In a controversial move that was decried by the Russian clergy, Solomnia was banished to a monastery, and Vasily was married to Elena Glinskaya, niece of his Lithuanian turncoat. Elena successfully bore Vasily two sons, Ivan and Yuri, guaranteeing the succession. It was during Yuri's reign that the legend of Moscow as the Third Rome or Second Constantinople gained serious traction. Already, during the final decade of the Byzantine Empire, Fomor of Tver had written a eulogy of the pious and grand prince Boris Alexandrovich, indicating Russia as the Third Rome. With the defeat of Constantine XI, Eastern Orthodox Christianity lost its Basileus, and Moscow, as the most powerful of the Orthodox principalities, having successfully broken the yoke of the Mongols, was perceived as the natural inheritor of Roman Imperium, alone capable of defeating the Muslims and restoring Christian imperial authority to Constantinople. This, despite the head of the Orthodox world, Patriarch Gennadius Scholaris, mentioned on our previous two streams on Mehmet II and Suleiman the Magnificent, legitimating the rule of Mehmet II as the true successor of Rome. While the marriage of Sophia to Ivan III bolstered that claim to the Third Rome further, Ivan partook of no campaign against the Ottomans. To the contrary, the Ottomans were natural allies to the Muscovites in their more immediate temporal struggle against the Lithuanians. In 1492, Metropolitan Zosimus, in his Paschalion, declared Ivan III as the new Constantine and Moscow as the new Constantinople. Philotheus took this idea further, based on the Apocalypse of St. John, and here is the King James Version. "The beast that thou sawest was, and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit, and go into perdition. And they that dwelt on the earth shall wander, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was, and is, and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains, on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings, five fallen, and one is, and the other is yet to come. And when he cometh, he shall continue a short space." Verses 9 and 10 are taken to be Rome, which Philotheus interprets as the fall of the Christian kingdoms, which will come together in a single kingdom. Two Romes have fallen, and a third stands. There will be no fourth. The fall of Constantinople was predetermined as a punishment for the Council of Florence, though again, this interpretation is complicated by Mehmet II's empowering of Gennadius in the anti-Union faction of Orthodox clerics in Constantinople. The rhetoric of the Muscovite clerics then turned on the Patriarch of Constantinople, claiming that Moscow, as the seat of an Orthodox emperor, was the appropriate seat of the Patriarch. The Palaiologos dynasty, while conducive, the Palaiologos descent, while conducive to the imperial claim, in and of itself was weak, since Andreas, Sophia's brother and heir to Thomas and Constantine XI, had sold his rights to their most Catholic Majesties of Spain, Ferdinand and Isabella. If one is to take inherited succession as given, a principle established in Western monarchies, it was never established in Rome. As Mehmed and all subsequent Ottoman rulers were Muslims and thus heathens, all Holy Roman emperors were Catholics and thus heretics, Orthodoxy was thus placed at the centre of the Third Rome mythology, a teleology commencing not just with Ivan III and Sophia Palaiologina, but with Vladimir the Great, the great Christianizer of the Kievan Rus, and his Byzantine wife of the Macedonian dynasty, Anna Porphyrogenita. Ivan IV, known to posterity as Grozny, or Terrible, though perhaps a more apt translation would be rendered as Ivan the Formidable, inherited the throne at the age of three from his father. After a five-year regency, Elena Glinskaya, his mother, died at the age of 27, leaving Ivan at the mercy of the boyars of the clans Shuisky and Belsky. Ivan and Andrei Shuisky were famed for their arrogant and violent behaviour, as recounted by Ivan in his letters to Kurbsky. Andrei was punished for his treatment of the Tsar by being thrown into a cell and devoured by ravenous dogs. The coups and counter-coups of Ivan Shirsky and Ivan Belsky were ended by the rise of Metropolitan, later Saint Macarius, and his chosen council of boyars, which facilitated the coronation of the young Tsar Ivan. In 1547, At the age of 16, Ivan was crowned formally as Tsar by Macarius, rather than Grand Prince, in a new ceremony in Dormitian Cathedral. His quick marriage to Anastasia Romanova cemented his independence from his regents further. The elevation of Ivan formally to Basileus or Tsar represented the transfiguration of the Russian monarchy into that of divine defender of the Orthodox Church in particular, adjacent to Christ. Macarius' conception of the Tsar as defender of the privileges of the Church was confirmed by the subsequent Stoglav Synod, which not only proclaimed the inviolability of Church property and Church jurisdiction over ecclesiastical matters, but de facto declared the Russian Church autocephalous of the Greek Church, with its own rituals and duties as distinct from the latter. This remained the status quo until the controversial Sobor of 1667 and the reforms of Nikon under Tsarevich Alexei, which created the Raskol Russian Schism, the so-called Old Believers. In 1549, Ivan the Terrible created the Zemsky Sobor, the Land Council, an imitation of the Estates General in various European monarchies such as France, though with little more power than to consent to the Tsar's initiatives. Of course, he empowered the chosen council which had helped in his accession, and ridding him of his former regents, the Shirskis. In addition, the Tsar was responsible for the creation of the Streltsy, Russia's first standing army, and it would use the standing army to great effect in terms of transforming Russia from a simple state, the unification of all the Rus principalities, into a multicultural and multi-religious empire. In foreign affairs, the Khanate of Kazan had prevaricated from Russian vassal to raider state, an eerie reminder of the legacy of the Golden Horde. In 1552, at the age of 22, Ivan finally resolved to undertake the final conquest of Kazan, thereby opening up Russian expansion south through the Volga and east across the Urals into Siberia. Having isolated the Khanate diplomatically, and even dismantled and reconstructed the fortress of Skievask from further up the Volga down to essentially oppose the city of Kazan, on the 2nd of October, Ivan took the city, massacred its Tatar denizens, and liberated the Russian slaves of the Tatars. To celebrate his victory, Ivan had St. Basil's Cathedral in Moscow constructed, seen here in the centre. And of course, it's one of the most iconic landmarks in Moscow if you ever do visit the city. With Kazan conquered, Ivan took the Khanate of Astrakhan, the remnant of the Golden Horde, establishing Russian rule over the Volga and thousands of Muslim subjects. The expansion of Russia southwards brought Russia into serious contention with the Ottomans for the first time. In 1558, Ivan gave the Stroganov family the right to colonize the lands over the Urals. In 1577, the Stroganovs petitioned the Cossack Yermak Tumofeyevich to conquer Siberia from Khan Kushum. The Russian expedition defeated the Siberian Khanate at the Battle of Chuvashkep, allowing for its annexation to Russia. In 1586, shortly after Ivan's death, the Russians established the city of Tyumen, thereby beginning the Russian colonization of Siberia. In the West, Ivan was concerned about expanding Russia's maritime trade through the Baltic. Ivan III had established a port in Narva, Ivanigrod, to encourage trade and even immigration from the Hanseatic League, and the German cities in general being great craftsmen, which would have benefited Russia greatly. By 1550, however, Ivanigrod, despite having been established by his grandfather some 70 years earlier, had been all but ignored by the Hanseatic League, and the Germans instead preferred to trade through Livonian ports such as Riga and Reval, ensuring that Russia was essentially economically isolated. Ivan had attempted to bypass the Baltic Sea entirely by supporting the English foundation of the Muscovy Company under Richard Chancellor through the White Sea port of Arkhangelsk. Yet despite the privileges Ivan afforded to that company, the White Sea, being frozen many months of the year, was simply not viable as a major trade port. To remedy this, Ivan made Livonia his principal target of acquisition and invaded Livonia in 1558. To put this in perspective, Livonia was the last remnant of the Northern Crusades, the Terra Marina, though by 1558 the region had collapsed politically into a number of independent bishoprics. The region was disunited, yet rich, and surrounded by ambitious neighbours in Poland, Lithuania, Sweden and Denmark. The Russian invasion was originally welcomed by Livonia's Baltic population, who had been under German rule for 300 years. Despite the crushing victory over the German knights at Agrimi, the Russians were unable to take the major cities such as Reval, Riga, and Tallinn. The Livonian Order dissolved and subjected their lands to Lithuania, who in turn guaranteed religious freedom to its subjects. Many of the denizens were Lutheran, and the Lithuanians were staunchly Catholic. And of course, they guaranteed the continuation of the German administration, thereby winning the support of the German aristocracy, whilst Russia had attempted to undermine them. Tallinn and Estonia, meanwhile, submitted to Sweden. Ivan IV invaded Livonia again, only to be defeated by the Lithuanians at the Battle of Ula and the Battle of Sasniki. Sigismund of Poland then effected the Treaty of Lublin, creating a union between the crowns of Lithuania and Poland, and by extension, Livonia, a behemoth rival against Russia, which would nearly destroy it in 40 years' time, during the height of the Time of Troubles. When Sigismund died in 1572 and the Russian monarchy became formally elective, Ivan failed to install his younger son, Fyodor, as king. From 1570 until 1577, Ivan successfully occupied most of Livonia, placing a Danish duke, Magnus of Holstein, on the throne of a client kingdom in the hope of profiting from the Danish-Swedish enmity. In 1577, at the height of Ivan's power, Magnus defected, while the same year, Stephen Batory was elected king of Poland. Batory and Ivan contested the fortress of Venden, the strategic heart of Livonia, and the former capital of the order, which by 1578 was decided decisively in Batory's favour. From Venden, Batory sieged Pskov and attacked and seized the city of Politovsk, while Sweden retook Narva and gained control of Ivanigrod, Ivan's original port in the Baltic. Under the Truce of Jan Zapotsky, Russia lost all of its gains the previous 25 years and remained isolated from Baltic trade. Yes, trade with Europe and diplomatic links have been established, and one of the foremost diplomatic goals of Ivan IV had been to create an alliance with Elizabeth I of England. Nevertheless, it would be under his ultimate successor, Peter the Great, some 150 years later, that Russia would finally be able to establish a permanent military and naval presence in the Baltic Sea and therefore open up Russia to European trade. An epidemic in 1570 hit Russia's major cities, resulting in the death of roughly a third of the denizens of Novgorod and Moscow. Simultaneously in the south, the Crimean Khanate began launching vast raids aiming at capturing Christian slaves. With an army of 40,000 men, Devlet Jurei, exploiting the fact that Russia was embroiled in the Livonian War, set Moscow ablaze, resulting in the death of 100,000 Muscovites, leaving the city virtually uninhabitable for the court of Ivan for the remainder of his reign. To buy peace, Ivan offered to cede Astrakhan, only for the Russians to finally defeat the Crimeans at the Battle of Molodi under Mikhail Voronetsky. From 1547 to 1560, is the time roughly corresponding to Ivan's zenith, or the height of his popularity, which also corresponds to Ivan's marriage to Anastasia Romanova, the tenure of Macarius, and the influence of the priest Sylvester. However, with Anastasia Romanova's death in 1560, Macarius's death in 1563, and the defection of his companion, Prince Kurbsky, to the Lithuanians in 1564, and the declining fortunes of Russia in the Livonian War, corresponds to a significant change in Ivan's manner of rule. Characterized by authoritarianism and paranoia, the beginning of Ivan Grozny, or Ivan the Terrible. In winter of 1564, Ivan left Moscow for Alexandrovo Kremlin with no provision for the government and carrying the royal treasury with him. Ivan had effectively abdicated, declaring that the corruption and treason of the nobility and clergy had made his rule impossible, while intimating that he bore the peasantry no ill will. Fearing that the Muscovite mob would attack the impotent boyar court, the boyars appealed to Ivan to return. Ivan accepted, on the condition that he be granted autocratic powers outside of the legal limitations to find, execute, and confiscate lands of traitors with no interference from the boyars or the church. The Oprichnina, literally meaning aside or exceptional, under the Tsar's personal guard, the Oprichniki, roughly corresponded to the old territory of the Novgorod Republic, as well as the province of Suzdal. The Oprichnina, the lands under the direct autocratic rule of the Tsar, was contrasted with the Zemschina, the lands under the influence of the Boyar Council. The boyar lands in the Oprichnina were largely confiscated, and boyars resident in the Oprichnina, around 12,000, were forced to move to the Zemstchina. The Boyar lands were then redistributed to the Opishniki, who were entirely dependent on the Tsar and bore no ties to the local inhabitants. To prevent the peasants following their lords, Ivan introduced the first limitations on peasant movement, a forerunner of the 17th century institution of Russian serfdom. When a meeting of the Boyars at the Zemsky Sobor petitioned for the end of the Oplichnina, Ivan re-intensified the purges and executed the petitioners. The executions extended to his cousin, Prince Vladimir Andreevich, and prominent Boyar Ivan Fedorov. Metropolitan of Moscow Philip began to openly challenge the Tsar's authority, refusing to bless him during the Lent of 1568, citing the oppression of the Oplichniki. In response, Tsar had Philip deposed on fantastical charges of sorcery and imprisoned in the Otrok monastery, and later strangled on the Tsar's orders by Malyuta Skutarov, the Red Minion, one of the most notorious of the Tsar's Oplichniki. Ivan then turned his attention to Novgorod. Despite its conquest under Ivan III, Novgorod was still home to the second largest contingent of Boyars in Russia, separate institutions dating back from the Republic. At the height of the Livonian War, Novgorod was the center of the military frontier. In addition, Ivan doubted the loyalty of the border garrisons after Izborsk defected to the Lithuanians. In particular, Ivan was convinced of a conspiracy led by Archbishop Pimen to surrender the city to the Commonwealth. Ivan believed that the city would defect and then apostatize to Catholicism, a la the situation between Ivan III and Marfa Posadnitsa. Ivan arrived in the city to be greeted by Pimen, who was arrested and paraded around the city on a mare's back, mocked by Russian minstrels, while Ivan proceeded to sack and destroy the city, killing anywhere up to 3,000 denizens and scorching most of the arable land around the city, devastating Novgorod's economy and ensuring it would not recover. With the 1517 massacre of Novgorod, combined with the devastating epidemic of the same year, the city could never boast of its autonomous status or rival Moscow economically or politically ever again. Ivan then moved to target the merchants of Pskov. In the wake of the fire of Moscow in 1571, Ivan dissolved the Oplichnina, the power of the nobility significantly reduced. Further, in 1575, Ivan had confiscated most of Russia's monastic lands. Ivan had six wives, which we know of, and possibly as many as eight wives. However, the exact number of wives that Ivan had is up for debate, considering that after the death of his fourth wife, Anna Koltskaya, the church refused to sanction his marriages. Tsarevich Ivan, the son of Tsar Ivan and Anastasia Romanova, began to question his father's failures in the Livonian War. After the fall of Venden in 1478 and the subsequent siege of Pskov, the Tsarevich had demanded to take control personally of the front. In 1481, the Tsar physically assaulted the Tsarevich's pregnant wife, Yelena Sheremeteva, over her offensive manner of dress. The assault, in all likelihood, led to the miscarriage of her child. The Tsarevich confronted his father, only in turn to be accused by his father of inciting rebellion, causing the Tsar to strike the Tsarevich with his imperial scepter, mortally wounding his son, causing the Tsar to cry out, "May I be damned, for I have killed my son." Praying for a miracle, the Tsarevich died 4 days later. The effect of this was that after Ivan the Terrible's death, Russia was left without a competent leader. Fyodor, the younger son, was incapable of ruling and died without an heir. With the mysterious death of Ivan's younger son Dmitry, the Danilevich dynasty that had ruled Moscow for three centuries had failed, leading Russia into the time of troubles, a period of civil war, invasion, and ultimately the rise of the Romanov dynasty. Nevertheless, Ivan had set the temper of Russian autocracy, implemented the first restrictions of freedom on the peasantry, and significantly weakened the power of the boyars, accelerating a process that had begun under his grandfather Ivan III, and we could be completed by Peter the Great. While Ivan had ascended to power with the support of Macarius in an attempt to transform Russia into a theocratic state modelled as the Third Rome, Ivan had attacked and brutally attacked the persons and property of the Russian Church. Nevertheless, the legitimacy of Moscow as the Third Rome was bolstered with the recognition of the Tsar's title by the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople in 1560, and, finally, the elevation of the Metropolitan of Moscow to Patriarch of all the Rus in 1589. With the elevation of the Romanov dynasty in the following century, Russia's imperial status will be recognized in the West, while Russia's pretensions as the protector of Orthodox Christendom will be exemplified under Catherine the Great's Greek plan and the foreign policy of Nicholas I, who conceived of the motto Orthodoxy, Autocracy, and Nationality, and himself as the protector of all Eastern Christians under the Ottoman Empire. Now, thank you very much for listening. I'll quickly check to see if we have any super chats to read or any questions you would like me to answer while I'm here. And if there are not, I will go and I'll bid you adieu until Friday. Right, it appears that we don't have any super chats, so I'll say good night. So I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank all of my wonderful channel patrons for listening to this lecture. If you like this lecture, please like and leave a comment in the description. Otherwise, there is reading for the seminar on Friday. And I would recommend that you all meet us on Friday with Marcus Furius Pertinax and Columba to discuss the subject in depth. Otherwise, thank you all again very much for listening, and good night.